Mike Leonard in the studio. Mike, you've had a busy summer. You've been all across the country. You've been working. And we've had you on the show a bunch, but it's good to see you face to face.
Yeah, nice to be here live, John. Very exciting. And I think it's our first live fall session, wouldn't you say?
I'm in my hoodie. Although it's not technically fall, you know.
Yeah,
it's meteorological fall, but it's not.
It's fall in Chicago.
It is. It sure feels like it. Mike Leonard, of course, from Leonard Trial Lawyers. Or is it attorneys? I've already forgotten.
No, Leonard Trial Lawyers. Why? How quickly you forget somebody who comes on a show on a regular basis.
Yeah,
wow.
I know, right?
Wow.
All the time.
Wow. Lisa Ridian recognizes me. But,
Leonard. You know. And you're a federal defense attorney. You do whistleblower work as well. And when you come on, we either talk about what's happening in the news or we just take people's questions. I'm up for anything today. 312-981-7200. We're with you till 2 o'clock and Northwestern football. Usually you have questions for me.
Well, yeah, it's a time of year, John, so we have to cover, first off, our Bears prediction. Last year, you were, I think, relatively optimistic, and I was not.
Really?
Yeah,
That doesn't sound like me, but okay.
I think that's how it went. I don't know. We should probably find that broadcast or bury it. But we need our Bears predictions. I'm going 7 wins.
Really? Well, we do have the ability now, having seen the first game, to help with this.
It wasn't particularly pretty, especially I was really bummed because I thought, okay, Rodgers is out of town now.
Yeah.
At least we can be competitive every time we play Green Bay, and it certainly was not the case.
I'm on the record before the season started at 6-11.
Six? Okay. I'm going to go 7, and then when the season's over, when we have a broadcast, we'll bring Pete's in. The loser has to buy, right?
Okay. Good, good, good.
And then I think most of America, like me, is really focused on the Iowa-Western Michigan game today.
Okay.
You know, I'm an Iowa graduate, John, and I'm going Hawkeyes 31-14. That's my prediction. I know you don't have any interest or care.
We care about Northwestern football here, Mike Leonard.
Of course.
As the carrier station.
Of course.
Good luck to those other teams. But
okay. Well, they are going to play.
Cats.
They are going to play this year at Wrigley Field.
That's right.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool.
It'll be fun. What else is going on in your world? You've got a potential of a lot of trials coming up. How does a lawyer manage the potentially half dozen trials in the next few months?
Your head sort of explodes, and then you just feel like you have to just kind of break it down on a piece-by-piece basis and get prepared for each one. Some of them you're preparing for, they're a couple months ahead. Some are a couple weeks ahead. Some are next week. So you're kind of just always working ahead, but obviously the focus is on the one that's the closest in hand, right? So we start one on Monday, then we have one the week after that. And if things go the way they look, we'll probably have several more before the year ends. So that's the most fun for me, is trying cases and being in the courtroom. So it's just all the prep leading up to it and the stress and anxiety leading up to it. But the most fun is actually just being in the courtroom.
There's a lot of talk, obviously, about certain people that have a lot of cases coming up and all the documents that people have to go through. And in fact, I'm talking about former President Trump, of course, and in one of his defenses where he was trying to push one of the trials to 2026, I think that in their filing, they even mentioned that if you were to stack the pieces of paper on top of each other, I forget what the analogy was, but I think it might have reached outer space or something like that. How do attorneys manage sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of paper that they have to read through?
Now, I would almost think this was a setup, John, because I spent a good portion of last week on one of my cases doing electronic document review. So it's gotten easier than the old days, but in the old days when I was a young lawyer, everything would be paper. There was no such thing as all these documents being scanned in. So you'd get a document production in a case, which could be, you know, a limited amount, or it could be hundreds of thousands to millions of pages, and you literally would be going through boxes page by page, you know, looking through a whole bunch of different people, which of course, number one, made it very ineffective, because the idea that your colleague, you know, everyone's going to be on the same page and what they're looking for and is going to find everything. It's very hard.
He or she might see something differently than you do and something could be missed.
Exactly. So, and then you literally sometimes were, you know, the defendant would give you access by, you know, I'm talking about a civil case, by, okay, yeah, here's the trailer full of documents, you know.
Trailer.
You can spend your summer here. I spent like a summer in St. Louis one time when I was a young lawyer. And literally we're looking, pulling boxes out of a trailer and then tagging them hot or not hot or irrelevant. But things have evolved a lot. So now what's typical is you have a vendor who scans everything in. And again, though, it could be anywhere from dozens to hundreds of thousands to a couple of million pages. In the Trump case, I know it's an excess of that.
Yeah.
But what it does also, it's sorting them. So, for instance, you can run searches. You know, I'm looking for the all emails from Joe Smith Or I'm looking
this
only,
word.
Yeah, or I'm looking for a keyword searches, or I'm looking for Joe Smith to Mary Johnson or whatever. So, you know, what would take hundreds of hours or weeks or months is much more streamlined. So in that case that you're talking about,
yeah,
clearly they are exaggerating in terms of how long it's going to take.
And but it's
a legitimate concern.
I was just going to ask that. We got to get to the news, but sure. Yes or no, it's a legitimate concern. You'd say yes.
Yeah, you got me. You got my yes, and now you're going to cut me off and go to a commercial, aren't you?
Nope, just straight to the news.
Okay, great.
Mike Leonard. Leonard Trial Lawyers here. We got some texts to get to, Mike.
Let's do it, John.
We were talking before about how many hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that you got to read, and it's tough. It's a little easier now with some credit, but with some technology. 520 says, give credit where it's due, though. Don't paralegals do much of the prep for the attorneys to review?
Oh, I would say 100% that's true. The amazing thing about paralegal jobs, and it varies so much by what law.
Can you explain what a paralegal is really quickly?
Yeah, so It's really someone who works at a law firm who's not a lawyer, but's doing legal related tasks.
Okay.
It could be, the variety is immense. It could be anywhere from reviewing documents, you know, the other side produces documents like we just talked about. They could be the primary reviewer, like, hey, we need to find, you know, all the relevant documents about this subject matter or this issue or this keyword, or we need to find, it might even be more broad and open-ended search, you know.
Like, so it's not just pushing papers. These people need to know the cases. They need to be smart.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can't not know something about the case and do the document review. I mean, you could theoretically do it. You could give someone a task where, hey, just find me emails between Joe and Ted. You could do that. But the more valuable use of paralegal time is to actually have them doing substantive review, meaning they know something about the case. They're advancing your work because they're making it easier. They're narrowing the documents down. They're finding hot documents, as we would call them, that are keenly relevant to a deposition or a defense or a witness at trial. But what paralegals do is very broad-based. It could be anywhere from, you know, minute tasks like, hey, you know, copy these documents or take this to court, versus very substantive tasks. Like, you know, in civil cases, you have to answer discovery, meaning in any civil case, one side gives the other side written questions and requests for production of documents. Paralegals who aren't lawyers can do a lot of that work, mm-hmm. which is really a law-related task. Of course, they can't sign off and send it out. The attorney's going to review it, but you're really doing what a lawyer does in a lot of instances. And then, of course, I think you asked me during the break, you know, what is the pay scale? It varies immensely. Paralegals can make a ton of money or not. It depends on the law firm where you're working at. And, you know, some of the big law firms in Chicago and nationally pay, you know, paralegals handsomely, and then some of the smaller firms don't. But some of the smaller firms do because they rely upon them so greatly, you know.
Do some paralegals use it as a springboard to decide whether maybe to become a lawyer, maybe they go to law school at night as a paralegal? I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. All of the above. I think you find a lot of instances where people aren't sure about law school or they are sure, but they're going to go in a year or a couple of years. They want to work at a law firm, kind of experience that. And of course, it really depends upon what type of law you want to get into. You know, for instance, if you're working at a civil firm as a paralegal, not going to give a great insight into a criminal defense practice and vice versa, but it does give you a sense of the practice of law and what you have to do. And, you know, that experience can be fantastic or not, right? And that might kind of judge whether or prejudge whether you want to continue in it. But you do say that often where people are thinking about law school or they know they're going. And sometimes it makes that decision yes. Sometimes that makes that decision no.
Are paralegals in high demand?
I would say so, yeah, especially now. I think so. I think it's hard to get people for anything, but I think the paralegals are definitely in high demand.
Okay. And I asked that because a 630 texted us. He or she is a 33-year-old nurse. They work in health insurance. They don't like the outlook of how that world is going, although healthcare is a great field to work in, but they're not happy with rising healthcare costs, no legislation going around, blah, blah, blah. I don't mean to blah, blah, blah to pass over, but I understand their point. They've considered pursuing a law degree, maybe at Northwestern, but I wonder if it's worth pursuing. Just curious on your thoughts on that. Someone changing their career, 33 years old, worth pursuing?
I think if you have the passion for it and you have the desire, 100%. I mean, of course, there's all these other considerations.
Cost.
And Northwestern, like every other law school in Chicago, is costly. And I'm actually happen to be an adjunct professor of trial practice there, John.
Oh.
So maybe I could sometime encounter this person. They would mm-hmm. take trial practice someday, and we could have this discussion about how she was listening to John Hansen and persuaded her to go to law school.
There you go.
But in any event, no, I think that people oftentimes make that move when they're years out of undergrad. Like a lot of people in the old days, it was, I think, a high percentage of people would go directly from undergrad to law school.
That seemed to be the track when I was in college.
Yeah, but I'd say definitely not so much now. I mean, people seem to be waiting a year, 2 years, even longer to go. And I think that's kind of nice to give you a little seasoning, real world experiences. And but sometimes people want to just to have the momentum academically.
They want to do it.
They want to go, which is great. But I strongly encourage it. But if you have the passion to do it, and I think it helps to have some idea of what you want to pursue. Because just saying you're going to law school in general, it doesn't mean necessarily anything because there's so many different paths you can take. So right. I would do some exploration into which path I want to go into. But the difficult part is not working a law firm or being a lawyer. It's hard to really know what those practice areas are actually like.
Right.
So if you could even get a lawyer who, as we know, John loved to talk about themselves,
yes,
could talk about, you know, the area of law to them. But I'd say absolutely, yeah.
You know, it's funny because a lot of people, I'm 39 now, and a lot of people my age.
Wow, you're going to be 40 next year?
Oh, yeah.
Is it going to be an on-air 40th birthday party? Or
I don't know. I usually take my birthday off.
Okay.
A lot of my friends we're getting to the age where we realize that our chance of becoming a pro athlete are quickly dwindling in that.
Not with you, John. I don't think hope is lost with you.
Most of them are way younger than us already. I mean, that's been the case now probably for 10 years, but like we're at the point now where at 39, most pro athletes are done. They're retired.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but I don't worry about that because that was never an expectation, but I am now at the point where I realize I'll never be a Supreme Court justice. Because you're going to be nominated in your 40s, most likely, or young 50s. I'd better get into constitutional law soon, and that would mean I'd have to get to law school now, 42. Maybe I still got a couple years to play with here.
You got time. In my law school class, there was definitely people who were in their 40s and some in their 50s, actually. I mean, not a ton, but...
Oh, yeah, but they're not going to be Supreme Court justices. They've missed the track.
Probably not, John. I mean, you might not be a Supreme Court justice for other reasons, but you know, not just because it's so late in the game. We're not going to talk about that.
Well, the hours and hours of tape they could play for me from WGN
exactly,
Radio at hearings.
Exactly.
The stupid things I've said on the air.
Oh, yeah, you're toast. Oh, you're toast, yeah. We're not going to get through that confirmation hearing.
Yeah, no.
I would defend you, but I would just I would tell you up front, buddy, we're not going to win this one.
I started at overnights too, you know, filling in. And when you're on from 2 to 5 in the morning sometimes.
Are you just really trying to just talk?
Yes, and you say some really dumb things. All of which the other side of the aisle will find and make sure that I don't play. Okay.
Absolutely.
We gotta take a break. Afterwards, we're only gonna have like 7 or 8 minutes go so fast.
That's
we got Northwestern football coming up. So I want to do kind of a roundup of the weekend legal news, okay?
Okay,
sounds
good.
We'll do that after this on WG. Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers. Where should people reach you at, Mike, by the
John, way? John, 312-380-6559.
Say it twice. It's radio.
312-380-6559. I can't even say it twice.
Who should be calling you?
People charged or being investigated for crimes. And also those who are looking to be whistleblowers or who are whistleblowers.
Investigated mean they've gotten a letter or they know or the FBI came by or...
Yeah, you know, remarkably, sometimes you'll actually get a letter that says you're a target or they're looking into you. More likely, you'll get a call or an unexpected visit from an agent who says they're...
Knock on the door.
Yeah, and luckily, if you're lucky, you're not at home and they leave the card and then you can call the lawyer and say, what's going on here? And we say, don't be talking to them.
Yes.
But that happens on a routine basis. And it's kind of sad because people a lot of times still, even at different ages, don't know their rights and don't know, I don't have to talk to that federal agent who's at my door.
Well, they feel intimidated like they should. And I think most people, maybe even if they did do something wrong or maybe they didn't do something they thought they are being accused of, they just are... They want to talk because they feel like they're in the right.
Yeah, everyone always says the old adage is they always come to us and say, well, gee, I talked because I didn't think I did anything wrong. It's like, yeah, but they did, and they're trying to, you know, get admissions from you to help build their case, not to necessarily help you.
Right. So. Okay, let's dive into a couple things. Hunter Biden indicted. We talked a couple weeks ago at the breakdown that happened at when he would try to reach that plea deal.
Yeah.
And now he's been indicted essentially on the same charges the plea deal was on, right? Nothing new here, really.
Not really. I mean, what they did, though, they did 3 felony counts, 2 of making a false statement in connection with attempting to get a gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one, which is really unique and almost never charged, is possessing a firearm while you are an addict, essentially. That's what it really means. So both of the sets of charges against him, because counts 1 and 2 are the same, you know, making the false statement, and then the one of possessing a firearm while you're an addict, pretty unusual charges in terms of they don't get charged very often. So in federal court, what you'll typically see is what's called a felon in possession charge, meaning you had someone who previously committed a felony, Now they possess a farm, and why they like those cases is that they can lock people up for long periods of time who they perceive to be bad guys. That's why federal prosecutors like those charges.
Mm-hmm.
The charge of making a false statement in connection with application, rarely charged and usually only charged with something else, you know. And then finally, the charge of being in possession of a firearm as an addict, almost never charged, you know. So I know there's a lot of talk about, hey, Hunter Biden's being treated with kid gloves, or he's being treated the other way. I mean, if you look statistically at these charges, they're very rarely charged. So you could make a strong argument that, you know, that he's not being treated better than anybody else. He's actually being charged, you know, treated a little bit worse than everybody else.
Yeah, and that's the problem with politics today. When there was talk of the plea deal, certain people said, oh, he's getting this plea deal because his last name is Biden. And certainly this is not in a vacuum. This is on the backdrop of everything that's happening with the former president. And now people saying, even some people are saying he's being indicted for way less. So which statement is more true, that he is undercharged or overcharged? Well, I don't want you to put you on the spot.
I never feel on the spot with your question, John. I enjoy him. No, I think for the charge of, you know, being someone who's an addict who's possessed a firearm, almost never charged. So you could argue that that charge is so unique and so almost unheard of that you could say, you know, why is he being charged? The making of the false statement, also pretty rare. So I would argue if it weren't for him, good chance he would have what's called a pretrial diversion, meaning the charges would go away if he's good for a period of time, like 6 months to a year. So I'd say he's probably being treated on the gun case more harshly than he would than the average citizen.
Okay. And you're down the middle with this stuff, so I appreciate your opinion on it. We talked about
I'm not sure if I'm down the middle. I'm probably pretty pro-defense.
I guess what I mean is you're a straight shooter. When we talked about the plea deal, you were readily to admit how quirky some of the things were and how strange they were.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone's out there saying you're a Hunter Biden defendant, go listen on WGNradio.com to the previous discussion we had. It's under the Let's Get Legal section. It was a really great conversation about how the plea deal broke down. And you and I both said this is weird and squirrely and shouldn't have happened.
He was getting some special breaks there. So
yes.
He's not now.
That's what I'm saying.
I think we might even have a caller, John.
Well, we'll see. Radio will find out what's going on. Yeah. Wait, let me run the show, Mike. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I got it, John.
Let Iridian run the show.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Okay,
exactly.
So this is all under the backdrop of what's happening with the former president. News this week in the case in federal court in the D.C. district about the January 6th case. We call it, even though it has not a ton to do about that actual day, the efforts to overturn the election. He has continued to post on Truth Social about Jack Smith being deranged, and certainly he's entitled to that opinion. That's a First Amendment right, I think a lot of people believe, but he may have overstepped his grounds. At least that's what the judge thinks, right?
Yeah, well, there's always a line. First of all, there was an order in this case about what people could say, and that's not unusual. I mean, you can't do things to try to influence the jury pool, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's unusual that there was an order in light of his history and what he'd already said. So he probably overstepped the line, and then the question is, what's the judge going to do about it? You know, at a certain point, you have to take stronger actions. You know, when you hold someone in contempt or have a contempt hearing, somebody like that who's just going to ignore what the judge says, there has to be consequences. So I expect maybe not a huge consequence, but I think there'll be some consequence to this. And you know, the consequence could be anything from a monetary fine to eventually revocation of your release. You know, so I don't expect that to happen. You know, mm-hmm. I don't expect the judge to say, hey, you're coming into custody, but I do expect an admonition from the court, and maybe even a monetary fine could come down the pike.
There's four trials set to start, five if you include the E. Jean Carroll civil trial, but let's ignore it, but I'm just talking about the federal cases, the Georgia case, and the New York case. Four scheduled to start in 2024. I'm setting the over-under at a half. Do you think that over or under some of those cases start in 2024?
I think probably one gets tried.
That's what I was thinking.
I think one. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to say that they all could go. There's no way. The breadth of some of those cases, especially some of the new stuff with multiple defendants, there's just no possible way.
Okay. Which one do you think goes?
Probably the Jack Smith case. I think that will probably go.
Florida or D.C.?
The D.C. and or the Mar-a-Lago case. I mean, I think those are prime candidates to go in 2024.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Okay, Mike Leonard, anything else you want to let our listeners know about?
the difference between a criminal act versus a constitutional case. Do you understand
that? I should never be putting you in front of the caller screen. John has probably got a great question, but we don't have enough time
okay,
to take
it. Okay, we'll hold John's question until next time. No, we had a good experience. We went out to federal court in Boston last week for a federal sentencing, and it was a unique case. It was a postal worker, federal postal worker, accused of essentially padding his expense reports by making up phantom trips, a mileage. Wow. And the government, which I believed was being very unreasonable, was arguing this individual should be put in prison for a year to a year and a half. Luckily, after argument and briefing and a sentencing hearing, common sense prevailed, and he's not going to serve any actual time in prison, which was, I thought, was a great result under all the circumstances.
Congrats to that. Okay, Mike Leonard, 312-380-6559. Thanks for your time. We'll talk again soon.
Good to see you, John.